This is Jason Mewes, and you are listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'll see you in the future, son. Snooch. Snoogans.
Good morning! Welcome to Too Much Scrolling for July 30th, 2019. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Chip Hassenflug.
We're just a couple of guys sitting around talking about things that are important to us. Hopefully they're important to you. And if you need more information, there's so many great ways to find more information. This week, Chip, as promised, I am finishing my week-long exploration of Weird Al Yankovic's work, his body of work, including going to see him live in concert at Ravinia on Sunday.
And did you enjoy a bottle of wine while you were out in Ravinia, Steve?
I'm not a wine drinker. I'm a beer drinker, Chip. And yes, I enjoyed a bottle of beer. And yes, it was a very enjoyable time. We had so much fun. There were so many people at Ravinia. This is a great venue for concerts.
This is a beautiful venue. And Steve, there's probably a lot of people out there. Do you know anybody who went there?
There were several of our friends and listeners who were there. Kevin Pollock, who plays Jake in the Blues Brothers locally, our local Blues Brothers tribute band.
Sure.
He was there, along with my orchestra teacher at school, Marissa, was there. And none other than Insane Ian was at the Weird Al concert.
Insane Ian?
Yes. Insane Ian, who is one of our local funny music producers, he's here with us today to discuss it. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning.
Welcome to Post Weird Al Talk. You went to the concert last night. Did you have as much fun as
yesterday? I did. Yesterday, I have to admit, was my 25th time seeing Weird Al in concert.
Wow.
And I've been a fan for a very long time, and not as long as some of my friends who were at the show. There are friends of mine who have been following Al for a very long time and had a lot more disposable income in the early years than I did. Happy Steve, it was his 71st Weird Al concert, and Marty, a.k.a. Torso Boy, his 85th Weird Al concert last night.
Wow.
So yeah, there's definitely, large numbers in the Al fandom, but it was a great show. Al performing with a full symphony orchestra.
Mm-hmm. As he should.
The Ravinia Symphony.
Uh-huh.
And, that's what the whole point of the tour is that it's called Strings Attached. He got the idea from doing the Hollywood Bowl shows a couple times last year and decided to take that on tour, and that's what we got this time. So it was a great show.
So is there a difference on seeing him on your silver anniversary performance versus seeing him early in his career?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of the differences between this show and those early shows that I saw, I think I first saw him on the Alapalooza tour. Okay. And a lot of the differences between this and those shows, I mean, he played a lot more of the newer songs from Mandatory Fun. Some of the songs are obviously different, but some of the videos he always changes out. Obviously, working with an orchestra, you're getting an entirely different sound for a lot of these songs. There's nothing quite like listening to Smells Like Nirvana and suddenly being backed by a giant 41-piece orchestra.
That was a great
moment. Not originally how the Nirvana track sounded, but definitely a cool way of doing that song.
An homage to Kurt Cobain, I guess.
Yes, that is. Yes. Smells Like Teen Spirit's parody, Smells Like Nirvana, yes.
Well, by Strings, Steve.
Al actually used to dedicate the song to Kurt when he passed away, around the time when that happened. For like the next year of concerts, he would dedicate the song to Kurt.
I was so impressed by how well Al can still jump around on stage, and his two moments in the crowd where he was playing with the crowd with a wireless mic walking through the audience, those were special moments for me.
Not just the crowd, but the security guys too. Invariably, every time I've seen Al, there's always at least one security guy who's doing his job and not watching the stage, uh-huh. And Al just messes with him.
It becomes a part of the show, and Al is so well prepared for that, just stepping over the one guy who was literally in his way, and Al went out of his way to step over this human being who's sitting.
Al is turning 60 this year, and you wouldn't know it to look at him.
That was my big takeaway.
Limber as ever. He still does the high kicks. Mm-hmm. I don't think he can put his leg behind his head anymore. I haven't seen him do that in a number of years.
Right.
But he still does the high kick.
But in the video, have the video of the olden days where he was still able to put his leg over his head and jump around.
Yeah.
Just like a guy from California, he must know yoga, Steve.
He is certainly a yoga enthusiast with a slight overbite and hair the color of strained peaches.
Strained peaches, yes.
I love this show. This was my sixth, maybe seventh time seeing Weird Al live, and I'm going to see him again in Peoria at the end of August. And boy, is he one of my favorite humans on the planet Earth.
Probably one of the best live shows anyone will ever see. Doesn't matter the tour, doesn't matter the style of tour that he's doing, it is always the best live show. I will say the Strings Attached tour is a little shorter in length than most of the tours have been because, obviously, we're dealing with having a full symphony orchestra and they can only do so much time contractually. Mm-hmm. That's why the tour is a little shorter this year. But still, usually on average, about 2 hours of the best entertainment you will ever get.
And it's a different string orchestra at every stop, right? This was the Ravinia
Orchestra. That is correct, yeah.
So
this was the Ravinia Orchestra because you were at Ravinia, and they've made a deal with all each venue and each city that they're in, to borrow whatever symphony is local. And what's amazing about that is they have very little rehearsal time and still come out sounding as fantastic as they do.
And they didn't play any opening songs. I see in the set lists from other stops that the orchestras around the country had been playing opening songs before Al came out. And our orchestra did not do that.
That was probably a little disappointing to me that they didn't have a warm-up overture mm-hmm. like a lot of the other venues have had on this tour. I will also say Al tweeted something a couple weeks ago, maybe about a month ago when the tour started, that certain dates were getting larger orchestras, and this one was supposed to be one of the ones with the larger orchestra, and then last night he said it was only 41 feet.
I saw that. I had been advertising on the show for the last few weeks this was going to be a 71-piece orchestra, because that's exactly what he said.
Not a 70.
A 71. But then when we got there, it was only a 41-piece orchestra.
Did they have a triangle?
Yeah, that's what I was telling people, friends of mine who I ran into at the show that night, that's what I was telling them, too.
Yeah, me too. All of my social media had quoted that quote from Al, who said this was going to be a larger venue and therefore a larger orchestra. And I was a little bit disappointed by that, but not majorly.
I was too, a little bit. Al's turned us into liars. But everything was still top notch and wonderful. So I don't mind that.
And one thing Chip brought up was, boy, the crowd, this community of people that go to see Weird Al around the country, we are a devoted bunch.
Not only devoted, but very diverse, too. There's a lot of people from a lot of different walks of life that you see at an Al crowd, be it age or social standing, I guess you could say.
Did you notice a lot of non-Weird Al fans at the concert at Ravinia? I was wondering if a lot of those people would be the normal Ravinia crowd who just happened to show up for a Weird Al concert.
There were one or two. Like, one of the ladies who Al was serenading during One More Minute
uh-huh.
certainly seemed to be that she was dragged to that show non-willing.
You'll love it! Come!
So, yeah, there were a couple people in the crowd who, obviously warmed up to Al, because how can you not? But at the same time, they did not seem to be of his normal ilk.
And that's my follow-up question. Do you think that Weird Al concerts are accessible, that anybody can go, anybody who's dragged there is going to have a good time?
If you're 9 years old or 90 years old, you will have a fantastic time at a Weird Al concert.
I agree with you. I think that everybody had a good time. I was pointing out to my 13-year-old, who was wearing my 27-year-old t-shirt, by the way, from the Off the Deep End.
27, excellent Weird Al number.
Yeah, from the Off the Deep End Tour t-shirt from 1992 on his 13-year-old body, I was pointing out to him, that woman has never heard these songs before and she's having a great time. I think everybody had a great time. I suggest that everybody across the country find a way to make it to the Weird Al concert in your area this summer.
Are you saying a Peoria pilgrimage here?
Let's go to Peoria. It plays in Peoria, I'll tell you that much.
And a Milwaukee march.
Milwaukee was on Saturday.
Where it was.
Milwaukee, yes, that was apparently...
Milwaukee was the night before, yeah.
Yeah, apparently that was a really fun concert.
I saw that kid in the Off the Deep End shirt.
Then you probably saw me.
I walked behind him and saw the tour dates on the back and went, oh, that's the Off the Deep End tour, I have that shirt.
That was my son. I was probably the larger human standing next to him. I told him that he could wear my 27-year-old t-shirt because I was slightly smaller 27 years ago.
Weird Al Time Works, yeah.
Weird Al Time Works. That is his watch company.
Film at 11.
Brings us to our Film at 11, our movie of the week. You got a chance to go see the new Quentin Tarantino movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
And this is a very Quentin Tarantino film.
Yeah.
It is a very interesting film. Let's just say, 65, 70 out of 100. You go to Quentin Tarantino films because you're looking for dialogue, you're looking for style, you're looking for sort of an homage to film history.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, there's a coolness about what he does that is very familiar, but also, you know, just sort of cutting edge there.
Yeah.
And always some gross scene that you have to throw in there to make everybody cringe a little bit. This film has everything that you could want from a Quentin Tarantino film. I don't think any Quentin Tarantino film becomes something for a lifetime, but certainly it's beautiful to eat it up and study it, and very much like you would study Kubrick.
Okay, so maybe this is a study in how to make a movie. It's got good plot, it's got good characters.
It's got a plot that you don't realize how it connects, but it does. It wraps up with a little bow at the end because you've got probably three stories going on at the same time that are not really connecting. They do connect at the end, and also, yeah, what can I say? And I don't want to give away what is unique about his films.
You also got to see The Art of Self-Defense.
The stars, of course, Mark Zuckerberg. And Mark seems to be an active actor out there.
Yeah, no, this is Jesse Eisenberg, who played Mark Zuckerberg one time, and he's stuck with that in your head, isn't he?
Well, if he ever shows up at Silicon Valley, uh-huh, I think that they just follow him around.
Boss, I have a question. No, I'm Jesse Eisenberg. No, you're Mark Zuckerberg.
This is an odd film.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to like this a lot more. You kind of think it's sort of like a Napoleon Dynamite type film.
Uh-huh.
Eisenberg plays a great character. This is definitely, he plays it so well. This sort of meek person who wants to become this alpha person. Yeah, it goes dark and it kind of pays off at the end. This is not a great film. Okay. I would say 45 out of 100.
All right. The Eye of the Beholder, The Art of Dungeons and Dragons. This is a documentary about those people that we've met at Lake Geneva at GaryCon.
That's right. We met all of these people. And sadly, I just did not have enough history to know who they were. They were very kind and gracious with that.
Mm-hmm.
This is a film where I get to learn who these people are. What's really interesting about it is many of these artists were kids. I mean, they were like your children.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, you know, sending in pictures or driving up to Lake Geneva to meet with Gary Gygax. And, you know, Northern Illinois, Southern Wisconsin seems to be this place where a lot of these people were from. So you get a little bit of history of where Dungeons and Dragons, the company, was built. You get a little bit of idea of the early manuals certainly had a... They definitely looked like it was a manual.
Mm-hmm.
But also the drawings were not the most professional. They certainly had a very loose place to them.
Okay.
And as the company grew, and it grew from Gary Gygax home to going downtown Lake Geneva to where there was a hotel they took over, to moving over to like a business park, they eventually started hiring, I think it was four, like honest to goodness, real artists. And they created all of those iconic thoughts, like how should a dragon look? What's the difference between a green dragon and a red dragon and all this other fun stuff? So all those arts, by the time it got to the regular public out there, that would be probably my generation. This is sort of, you know, how it grew to that point. I found it fascinating. It was a very interesting documentary. This is not for everyone, 50 out of 100, but certainly if you have interest in sort of how a company, a creative company, was built from, you know, being in a garage all the way up to what it was, this would be a good place to start.
You saw the movie Climax, which is certainly not a documentary.
This is not a documentary, although it does say it's based on a true story. I don't know if that's true. Steve, there's a lot of reading that I had to do in this film.
Really?
Well, it takes place in France.
Okay, so tell us the story about Climax. We talked about this a while back, but I don't remember.
All right, so this is a very strange film. So this film is definitely avant-garde. It's something that you go into and you need to really kind of be open-minded. It starts off like a documentary. We're interviewing a whole bunch of dancers. They're going to be part of a troupe. They're going to tour the United States. They're all excited, and they're all young. And so the idea is they eventually brought them all together, and the second part of the film starts off with this dance number. And they're doing this, you know, which you would anticipate being a very youthful dance as choreography is all together. It's very tight. And if you are a dance student or somebody who is interested in dance, you're eating this up because you're going, man, I would love to do this. So they're young, they're flexible, they're really, really good. And then it ends. And they're sort of in their dormitory. This is all takes place in their dormitory in like a great room. And the owner of this dormitory comes out, wheels out some sangria for everybody. There's some food, something to nibble on. And there's a guy up there who is normally part of the dance. He's playing the music for the dance routine.
Okay.
But he's going to play a little dance music for all these kids to go out and kind of enjoy themselves. So, you know, we get pump up the volume or, you know, whatever we have at the latest stuff. And, you know, they're all dancing and they're drinking sangria. And they're starting to do a little small talk between themselves. And imagine what young people talk about. They talk about, you know, is such and such attractive? And, oh, I slept with such and such. I did a little bit of this. So it's starting to kind of move into a different era. And they're dancing and having a good time. But certainly, this is their relaxing time. Bring out the cigarettes and kind of downtime. Well, the sangria starts working, Steve, and the talk gets a little bit bolder. It's, you know, a little bit more about what we do. Imagine you're at a club and you've had a few drinks and it's loud and you're talking and you're having a good time. And then all of a sudden something's going on. And at that point we realize that somebody has slipped some LSD into the drink.
Oh.
And this is where it gets dark.
Hmm.
And so the whole time you're going, wow, this is, you know, if you were a person who watched Fame or something like that, was totally into this Flashdance. Okay. Then it gets dark. And they start having all sorts of challenges. There's a person who cuts themselves. There's people who die in this.
Wow.
There's situations that are just, they're scary because you're not in control and you don't know what the control is. And all they want to do is get off of this. And then they start turning on each other, very Lord of the Flies type of way.
Wow.
And it ends with the police coming in and they're looking at the horror that that was experienced. The director of this has directed a number of films. Each one of them has been a unique experience. This is an experience type film. It certainly isn't for everyone, but there's enough stuff there that's familiar and then enough stuff that would just scare the mess out of you.
Wow.
I absolutely like this film. I would say 70 out of 100.
Wow.
But this is really, it's not for everybody. And it is. There's a dangerous, provocative point to it. Sexuality is part of it. And certainly a youthful experience that once someone would have experienced it, I don't think they'd want to experience it again.
Wow. That turned very quickly. Wow. You also got to see The Hate U Give. This came out at the end of the year last year and has been critically acclaimed.
It has. And I'm so sorry we have not seen this earlier. This film was something that our kids went to. There was an opening night to this. And they all went to like a Tuesday showing of this. So, you know, think about just middle America was told that this the young people were told this is an important film. You should probably go look at it.
Mm-hmm.
This is the story of African-American experience, Black experience in, I would say, in, you could say, suburbs or urban situation. This is like every other family. You want your family to do well. And so what could you do to help your children? So this Black family grew up. They decided that they were going to send their children to a better school system. Our star of this is Star. That's the name of our star in this film.
Protagonist, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And she describes herself as living in two worlds. So when she goes to school, she lives in a world that is what I would say is typical America.
Okay.
And then when she goes home, she is part of a poor community and basically an all-Black community.
Mm-hmm.
What ends up happening is she goes to a party. This is where she becomes very aware of this. She meets a childhood friend of hers, and they have share a history. And he's had a number of challenges. His grandmother is sick. He's basically gone to what some families have had to go to. He's selling drugs.
Oh, wow.
And so there's a drug situation that's going on there. But they're talking, and this is not a situation where this is going on. But there is a gunshot at this party.
Mm.
So everybody scatters. And he goes, listen, I'll just take you home. Just get in my car, and I'll take you home.
Mm-hmm.
And so they go home. And on the way home, they eventually get stopped by a police officer. Ultimately, he makes a decision and shoots this child,
mm-hmm.
This young man. And that's what creates a lot of the thrust going through this, because Star at some point has to recognize that she is part of two communities here. She's part of the typical American community, and she's part of the Black community. And the typical American community celebrates Black culture,
mm-hmm.
gives lip service to being diverse, but really struggles with understanding what some who experience the Black community are experiencing. And we think of the officer. Well, the officer made a decision.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine the challenges.
The pressure of any officer pulling over any person in a car, there's always that moment where they are nervous and things can happen.
But this was a young, mm-hmm. these are young kids.
Right.
These are not any different than our kids.
Right.
He shot and he died.
Mm-hmm.
And it most likely because of racial profiling. And that's what the book and the movie are asking you to say. This is racial profiling.
Mm-hmm.
And is this acceptable at this day and age? Well, you know, I'm not an officer in that situation, and I'm not a young person in that situation.
Right.
But I can tell you that part of getting you in the mindset of this Black family is the father sitting down and having a conversation with Star and her siblings,
mm-hmm.
about this is what happens when you run into the police. Your hands stay in a position that everybody knows where they are.
Mm-hmm.
You answer. You don't provide too much information. You provide the answer to the question. So the whole time you're going, well, is this acceptable? Is this the way? Listen, it's not about whether it's acceptable. This is what the perceived experience is,
mm-hmm.
for these young people.
Yeah.
So Star has to confront this because she is a witness to a murder. Does she go and become public as an outspoken person on this? Or does she basically just address this in as little way as possible and kind of go through college and stuff like this? I'm trying to get a better life for myself, like mm-hmm. every other family out there.
Right.
And ultimately, she says she has to speak out. Now, this is a very powerful message, a very powerful movie. I do think that most of us should watch this, mm-hmm. because if you don't understand what part of our society is experiencing, then it's very hard to find empathy with that,
mm-hmm.
and you understand that it's just much deeper than just a surface, like, you know, everybody, you should just listen to what the police officer says.
Right.
It's deeper than that.
Right.
And while you feel sorry for the police officer who made that decision, who feels very sorry for that, you're also recognizing, you know, the experience that kid's not here anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. I recommend this book. I would recommend this movie. Our children who are in high school were asked to read this book. So this is obviously very profound for them.
I have been hearing about this one. I do need to get to The Hate U Give. Now, I watched on Netflix, to really change gears really quickly here, I watched a series called Another Life, which does go to that two different parts of your life sort of thing, I think. Here's where it gets complicated. This is a science fiction story about a alien craft that lands on Earth and sits on Earth for 6 months with no communication with Earthlings.
Does Lois Lane show up, Steve?
This is not Arrival. Yes, it is very similar in story to Arrival, where we're trying to figure out what this alien craft is here for. The scientists in this one discover that it's sending a signal out into space, and the Earthlings decide that they're going to send a ship to the place where this alien craft is sending a signal.
And that's where Starbuck comes in.
That's where Katie Sackhoff comes in.
Is it an angel Starbuck, or is it just regular Star Trek?
It might be just regular Starbuck. I don't know. Maybe a half a Frappuccino. So anyway, Starbuck becomes the captain of this ship that's going to go to where this signal is being sent. But she has to take over this ship from another captain, and then
Apollo?
Zeus. No, this is a totally different person.
Lorne Michaels, was he there?
Lorne Michaels. This is not, as much as we look at Katie Sackhoff and think of Battlestar Galactica, that great series of Battlestar Galactica, Katie Sackhoff is a great actress, and she does a great job in this part. This movie, this series is just a beautiful mess of a story. Like, every scene, I'm looking at it, looking at Katie Sackhoff and her skill, looking at Samuel Anderson, who is Danny Pink from Doctor who plays the AI, the robot, basically, of this ship.
Never heard of it.
It's kind of like Data on or Spock on Star Trek.
Okay.
He's that non-emotional piece of this crew that is giving the information that they need at the right time. I look at J.R. Tanako, who is just a very interesting human being, and I look forward to what they are going to give us in the future. Every minute of this series is interesting, but put together, there's no story. The title of this is Another Life, and I have found nothing in the first 5 hours of this journey that indicates why it's called Another Life. There's no duality of anything about life here.
It's a slow burn, Steve.
It might be a slow burn. It's a 10-hour series on Netflix. You can go look at it. If you love Katie Sackhoff, you'll love the moments where she's in it. If you love Samuel Anderson, you'll love the moments when he's in it. If you love J.R. Tanako, then you'll love those moments as well. I didn't love this. Opening this week, we've got The Fast and Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw. You know, like Kibbles and Bits, only different.
Well, Steve, this is probably going to win the weekend if it wins Lion King.
Uh-huh.
So anyway,
I think this is going to make a lot of money.
They've got a huge franchise.
Uh-huh.
And what do we know, Steve? Vin Diesel is not in this,
right?
Because Dwayne Johnson and Vin Diesel obviously are like oil and water.
So they got Jason Statham instead. Is there a difference between Vin Diesel and Jason Statham?
They're all cool guys.
They're the same guy. And Idris Elba is in this one. We have never seen a Fast and Furious movie, but these are big movies. A lot of people are going to watch this one this week.
Family, Steve.
There is a right. There is a movie called Loose that is a very dark tale about what teachers can do, and sometimes a student might be the victim of a vindictive teacher here.
So this is this looks interesting.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these films we're going to go through right now are probably going to be streaming type films.
Yeah.
Going on. Maybe they'll have a week or two in the theater.
Yeah, this one features Octavia Spencer, who has been doing a lot of dark roles lately. The Nightingale, this is 1825, a young Irish woman is just...
She's in Tasmania, Steve.
Oh, she's an Irish woman in Tasmania who's taking on the wilderness and all the... Oof, darkness. Darkness. Go watch the trailer on The Nightingale. Jay Myself, this is the story of Jay Muse, right?
This is a documentary, and it is not about Jay Muse.
Oh.
It's about a photographer.
Oh, Jay Mizell.
But this is interesting. But anyway, let's go to one about Jason Mewes.
Oh, there is a movie about Jason Mewes. This is The Madness in the Method. This is Jason Mewes' directorial debut. It's a story about Jason Mewes.
Is he going to be typecast, Steve?
He is totally typecast. There is no doubt that his acting career is predicated upon one part that he got in one movie in Clerks, and now he's suffering from that.
Snoochie Boochie, man.
Snoochie Boochies. This may very well be Stan Lee's final film appearance, though. This might be the last time we see Stan Lee in a movie, so I will definitely be seeing The Madness in the Method. There's a movie called Them That Follow. This is...
Steve, this is an opportunity to use that southern accent that you always wanted to use.
Yes, this is your Appalachian area that you're so fond of.
Snake handling, Steve.
Snake handling. And religion. And religion come together. Caitlin Dever, who you loved in Booksmart, along with Olivia Colman, who I love in absolutely everything. And of course, Jim Gaffigan is there because, of course, he is.
Isn't he like the lightest guy there?
He's the dad in just about everything
He's
nowadays.
He's very pale.
The Operative is about a woman who is undercover in Tehran, action film that I don't really watch action films. There's a movie called Coyote Lake. This is, in my opinion, the 2019 version of Arsenic and Old Lace, where a group of people, ladies, have decided that it is best to eliminate certain people and to kill them because they were bad people.
On the U.S.-Mexican border.
Uh-huh.
And this looks very dark.
Very dark. There is, speaking of dark and weird movies, there's a movie called Lady World, where a group of 8 teenage girls are trapped in a party after a massive earthquake. Or was there an earthquake?
Well, this looks like Lord of the Flies, uh-huh. Second reference for this podcast. Uh-huh. But this looks it's awful, bizarre. Man. Bizarre is a better word. Oh my goodness, scary.
Featuring Maya Hawke, who we just loved so much in Stranger Things. She's in the mix in Lady World. There is an animated feature this week called Leo da Vinci Mission Mona Lisa.
Yeah, it looks like straight to video, Steve.
I don't even know why this exists. This is a weird, bizarre animated film for young people, all about Leo da Vinci and his young adventures.
Steve, let's just say we missed Mother's Day, but our mothers didn't recognize that. Is there a film we could share with them?
Yep, Netflix is bringing out Otherhood this week. This is Patricia Arquette, Angela Bassett, and Felicity Huffman complaining about how you didn't call them on Mother's Day.
Well, you know, at the end of July...
That's
somehow,
what you get.
Sometimes they
That's
have to make
get.
That complaint. And then they have to come out with a movie
That's
making
that
complaint.
That's what you get. You didn't call your mother on Mother's Day. This is what you get. You get Patricia Arquette coming out and just swinging.
This is your penance.
Book it. 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 Book it.
Brings us to our book at our book of the week. You know, we got a chance to talk to so many great people at Wisconsin Comic Convention. One person that we talked to that we had so much fun was John Jackson Miller. He has authored several Star Wars novels, mm-hmm. and today he is releasing his new Star Trek novel, Star Trek The Enterprise War.
And he loves to play in other people's sandbox. So he said, I love writing books on Star Wars, and I love writing books on Star Trek. And this seems like a very interesting story. Let's have him tell us about it.
First month on Tatooine, it's a Western. This is High Plains Drifter time here. It's actually modeled on the movie Shane. He's the mysterious stranger who's wandered into town. He wants to hang up his lightsaber. And he's got to start acting like he's a hermit. But he's having trouble giving up his old ways. The woman who runs the local general store suspects he's got to have a secret, because why would anybody else move to this place? We have also the local landowner who is in the middle of almost a range war kind of thing at the time, and he wants to make sure that this newcomer doesn't upset all of his schemes and machinations. And then, of course, we have the chieftain of the local Tuscan Raider band, who is the only person who realizes that this man is a wizard. This is where the legend of Obi-Wan as the crazy old wizard, and crazy old Ben, and also that old wizard, this is where that kind of begins, is in Kenobi. And again, that came out 5 years ago, a little more than 5 years ago, and it is my best-selling book pretty much to date. And it is a lot of fun.
All right. John Jackson Miller, author of Star Wars, all sorts of Star Wars books, and I see a Star Trek book, too. You're crossing genres?
Yes.
You're going to the other side?
Well, only people with the initials JJ can write both Star Wars and Star Trek. I send that joke many times before. It's not true. There have been quite a few people who have done both. I just got back from the printer yesterday, the first copy of this.
Wow.
And actually, the first copy of it, actually, I gave to Mike Stackpole, who I dedicated the book to because he was my mentor years ago. But this is the second copy. This book comes out on July 30th. It is part of the Star Trek Discovery line. It is what happened to the Enterprise during season one.
Okay.
It is AWOL during the Klingon War. We don't know where it is. I know where it is. We decided where it was, and it's in a war of its own, and it's not back because it can't come back, and it barely doesn't come back. And so this tells about Pike and also Spock. We find out why Spock is in the predicament he is in when we see him in season two.
Oh my goodness! Breaking news! That is a story that needs to be told. When we see the Enterprise in season two,
yeah,
it's a real moment.
Yes.
And Pike is on the list of the top three captains now because of the presentation of Discovery and the actor portraying Pike. This is the best Pike that we've ever seen in Star Trek canon.
That's
and,
right.
And your in-canon writing is exciting.
Well, in 2 weeks, I will be at Shore Leave in Baltimore, and so will the actors, Anson Mount and Ethan Peck. Spock and Pike, and my hope is that we can get them copies of the book there, and my hope is also that we can actually put the book on sale there.
Yeah.
But I'm working that out right now.
Wow. Fresh off the presses.
Well, this comes out
breaking news.
This comes out July 30th.
Mm-hmm.
And so tell us, how did you get involved with the Star Trek project?
I got involved with Star Trek because I had been recommended by my Star Wars editor. she formerly worked with Simon & Schuster, and Simon & Schuster does Star Trek.
Okay.
And, it was something where I had a hole in my schedule, and I actually sold a Star Trek pitch before I did any Star Wars at all. It was for an ebook series called Starfleet Corps of Engineers. That series was canceled before my story, which would have been written and would have appeared, was contracted for. And so I put that idea on the shelf. I ended up using it in a different way in a book called Star Wars: Lost Tribe of the Sith.
Nice.
And because I'm
very Douglas Adams of you.
Well, I'm an environmentalist writer. I try to recycle things. That's what happened. And then the opportunity, as I said, came up to write this ebook for just a novella, and then that led to me getting to write the Takedown novel. And Takedown was a standalone novel. That did well enough. They said, come along and write a trilogy. Or actually, I said I want to write a trilogy. And it ended up being one of the trilogies we did for the 50th anniversary. So that's the Prey trilogy. The joke was, it's Prey, P-R-E-Y, for Bird of Prey, because it's full of Klingons. The joke was, pray that it's going to be on time. which it was, but it was a situation where the books came out monthly, and I had to write them in advance all at once.
Sure.
And so it was challenging. But that is what led to me getting Star Trek Discovery, the Enterprise War. And of course, I had to have all these other stamps on my passport to be able to get to write that. So
tell me a little bit about writing for a property as opposed to writing your own universe.
Almost everything I've done has been in somebody else's sandbox. I've written over 3 million words. I own maybe 100,000 of them. And it is in part simply because, you get one opportunity, and that tends to lead to another, which tends to lead to another. I also simply came up as a journalist That's where I got my start. Is I was never really, you know, writing anything on spec. I always had a venue in mind, or somebody was already paying me to write something for somewhere.
Sure.
And so it is not normally my habit to start writing something where I don't actually already know who's publishing it. And that is something where, again, it has left me now, after, you know, 10, 15 years in the business, not owning much of anything.
Yeah.
But I'm going to work on that. I just have to, every time one of these opportunities comes up, it's very difficult to say no.
Sure.
But, you know, I think as time has gone on, I've started to get more selective. You know, I did a lot of video game novels and video game comics and fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty much off of that now. Because I don't necessarily think that adds a whole lot to my audience.
Okay.
In terms of, you know, the crossover between audiences, the person who's going to read your standalone novel is much more likely to be somebody who is liking your style in general. And, you know, if you only have one novel or something like that in a franchise, that you're not having a whole lot of people being exposed to you.
All right, so when you're writing in someone else's sandbox, do you have to have an end in mind?
Well, yeah, everything at every level is approved by the licensor. It's all invitation only.
Okay.
So, I do a lecture about writing in a shared universe, and one of the parts in it is about how you get to write the stuff. No one has ever sold a fan fiction to a licensor. Rarely has it happened. They're not allowed to even look at it. What they do is they approach you. They say, are you interested in writing something? Propose something for it. And they either have a timeline, you know, a thing in mind. We want you to write the story of how this happened. Or it's open, and they say, you know, we want you to just write something and just generally put it in this part of the timeline.
Okay.
And then it is approved at every step of the way, from the, you know, from the plot to the outline of the story, to, if it's a comic book, the script for the individual issues. And then they also look at the art, and they look at the word balloons, they look at everything. So again, it's very well managed, and it does require pleasing two sets of people before you even get to a reader.
And how does your background in journalism allow you to approach that more efficiently, I guess that would be?
Well, for one thing, I was an editor of magazines for many years. The longest amount of time I spent, I was editing the trade magazine for the comic book industry in the 1990s and early 2000s. So in that period, I was editing other people's work.
Okay.
Including my friend Mike Stackpole over here. We got to know each other 20 years ago because I hired him to write a monthly column. And so I know what I like in a writer. You want somebody who is on time. You want somebody who's not going to get you sued. You want somebody who's going to handle your properties safely and be an asset to your company, asset to your publication.
Sure.
In the case of licensed stuff, that is what you're trying to do. You're trying to do something. For example, I have a Lion King graphic novel that's out right now. And what they wanted from it is they wanted a story that ties in with the Lion King property that's coming out in this new movie by Jon Favreau, who also directed the Iron Man films. It's an original story using the characters from the original Lion King movie. It's just they've drawn the animals so that it's looking a little bit more realistic, like you see in the Lion King. And so what I did there is I tried to do something which makes you feel like you're still watching part of the Lion King movie. The jokes are consistent. There are gags that are happening in there. The funny things that happen. There's a section where we have Timon and Pumbaa, and Timon finds an egg, and it's a giant egg, and he ends up having to run around trying to protect this egg. And so, yes, and so what happens is, when Pumbaa is saying lines, he's just saying the same kind of lines he says in the movie, where he's always saying these acerbic little things,
yeah,
like this, the Timon finds this egg and he says, "It's wonderful. It's gigantic. It's golden." And Timon and Pumbaa says, "No, it's really off-white." Well, that's exactly the sort of thing that the character in the movie would say.
That's right.
And so when it went up to the people at Disney, when it went up to the people at Disney, they were able to look at it and say, "This is consistent with what we've got."
So you got tone right.
Yeah. Yeah, you, what you're trying to do is you're not trying to just put the whether it's Star Wars or Star Trek or Lion King or whatever it is, you're not trying to put their world on shuffle. You're not trying to just do a Mad Libs version of it. So, for example, Kenobi is not a novel where it's one Jedi versus one Sith Lord versus over one planet destroying thing. We've kind of already seen that. It's a Western. It breaks the mold, but it feels like Star Wars because it sounds like Star Wars. The characters say things like you would hear in Star Wars, and the themes are really connected to it. So again, when the Lion King movie comes out, this book is already out. It's called Lion King: Wild Schemes and Catastrophes, out from Disney Press and Dark Horse Comics. The hope is that kids will read that and parents will read that and say, this is consistent with what we know, and it's a fun book.
So if our listeners wanted to find more from you, where can they go to find more?
My website is farawaypress.com, where I have behind-the-scenes notes on just about everything I've ever done. I am on Twitter at JJMFarAway. I am on Facebook at John Jackson Miller. I also run Comicron.com, Comichron.com, which is the world's largest public database of comic book sales figures. That's a hobby. This is the actual day job. So,
I've run across that.
Yeah, that I said I was a journalist. I ran the comics industry's trade magazine. I saved all the data and kept it up. So I am adding data every month as it comes out. I'm also adding it in backwards. I just did a feature last week for the 30th anniversary of Batman. I posted the sales charts that were out in June of 1989 with detail on what was really out back then and what things were really selling. And if you before I started collecting that information on Comicron, no one knew, as I know, that month, June of 89, was the very first time that Batman, the comic book series, was number one since 1966.
Really?
Wow. That's some good data.
It had been Superman or Archie or Amazing Spider-Man or The Uncanny X-Men.
Wow.
Or
was that from the movie?
It was the buzz from the movie.
And Star Trek Discovery, The Enterprise War, is going to be available on July 30th.
Thank you
so much, John Jackson Miller.
All right.
Once again, that's John Jackson Miller. His book, Star Trek, The Enterprise War, is coming out today. You can find it on our Amazon store, amazon.toomuchscrolling.com.
Scroll with it.
Brings us to our scroll with it. You know, we had a whole conversation about Weird Al and going to see him in concert, and comedy music for me is a huge part of my life.
And a lot of people enjoy that genre.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of novelty songs or even takeoffs, where there's enough familiarity with the music, but also something fresh with it. So, Steve, is there an opportunity for us to go and see something fun?
Absolutely. Not this weekend, but next weekend, August 9th through 11th, you can join Insane Ian as he hosts the Fumps annual Fump Fest at the Holiday Inn Chicago O'Hare. Ian, tell us, what is Fump?
The Fump is the Funny Music Project. It is a collection or a collective of comedy musicians, and we release two songs for free every week on thefump.com, thefump.com, Tuesdays and Fridays, and occasionally Sundays. We will put out a new comedy song for free or for $1 for a high-quality download, and have been doing so since 2007. The Fump was created by Devo Spice, who is a comedy rapper, Rob Balder, who is a webcomics guy and also occasionally used to dabble in comedy music, and a couple people may be familiar with, Jonathan Colton. They were all on a panel together at a convention that no one attended. So instead, they all talked to each other about Jonathan Colton had been doing Sing a Week. And Rob and Tom, a.k.a. Tom is the real name of Devo Spice, wanted to talk to Jonathan about maybe using that method to make a service for comedy music. And thus, The Fump was born. On the first week of January in 2007, the first Fump song, C is for Lettuce, by Worm Quartet, hit. And it's been a fun ride ever since. We got the attention of the Dr. Demento show. Dr. Demento listens to The Fump every week, checks out all the songs there, and if he likes the song, he'll play a track on the show. And in the 11 years of The Fump's existence, for 10 of those years, we have had the number one song for the year on the Dr. Demento show.
Wow, that's a testament to the quality that your service is providing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're pretty proud of it. We have about 150 plus artists on the site. Maybe about 50 of those post on the regular, but we put out songs consistently every week. And after 2 months, we collect all of those songs onto a CD. So we just released volume 75 of The Fump.
Wow.
On CD. We've got a little bit of a backlog, over 1,300 songs. So, yeah.
Wow. So, can artists still become a part of this project?
Absolutely. We have two ways that budding comedy musicians, or even well-established comedy musicians, can get their work heard on The Fump. We have a submittal form on The Fump where you can submit your song to be on the main page, which is where the songs that post on Tuesdays and Fridays are posted. Obviously, these songs are also available on iTunes, etc. But you submit your song to that. The core membership of The Fump then vote on the song, whether they would like to approve it for main page. And if it gets approval, then obviously you get main page, and you get paid for any downloads that you get and any royalties from that point on once CDs are sold, etc. If it does not get picked for the main page, however, there is still the Fump sideshow, where unfortunately you would have to host the song yourself at like archive.com or something, but you can post the song on the sideshow and members can go there and download it for free as well.
So that brings me to a question about distribution. Has this age of the internet really changed the way that we get music, and especially small artists who are doing, you know, maybe a novelty song that wouldn't get played on the radio as such? Has the internet really made Fump what it is?
I think so. I think the Fump was kind of birthed because of that necessity that the internet has kind of brought to it, because, you know, digital services for songs, especially for comedy songs, there's always this glut of comedy music that, you know, is kind of Weird Al adjacent. A lot of people doing parodies on YouTube or what have you, and not really getting the audience that they want / deserve, and that's kind of the purpose that we feel the Fump fills. We are also making music videos for a lot of the songs that are on our site, but I think as a distribution center for comedy music, not just on The Fump, but finding the podcast feed for The Fump on iTunes or Apple Music or what have you, so that you can not just go to the site and hear it, but go to your favorite listening device and get your Fump tunes. There's definitely a good market for it, and we try to fill that market as best we can. You know, it's still a niche genre, so not everyone is as in tune or into the comedy music as obviously we are, but
really? I like comedy music?
But I always get this weird, like, sideways look, like they're a puppy when you point a rubber band at their head. You know, a sideways glance from someone when I say I do comedy music, and they're like, what does comedy music mean? And the easiest way to define it is, you know, like Weird Al.
Yeah.
But, you know, to get further into it, you're like, it's just, I tell jokes, they just happen to be in song form.
Right.
You know, most people think funny music, they're like, how are the notes humorous? No, that's looking too deep into it. No.
So we've got Fump Fest coming up here in Chicago, August 9th through 11th. You've had some great guests in the past. Who's going to be there this year?
this year, our guests of honor are the Double Clicks,
yes.
The sibling duo from out of Portland, Oregon. They are our guests of honor this year.
Nice.
They are performing on the main stage on Saturday, but we have a ton of other performers throughout the entire weekend as well. We've got performances by Tim Kavanaugh, Clearly Guilty, Carrie Dalby, technically local artist Robbie Ellis, although he's from New Zealand, he lives here in Chicago, Amy Engelhart, some jerk named Insane Ian.
I heard of him.
Library Bards, Lauren Mayer, Rob Perizonian, Raymond and Scum, The Shanty Shipwreck Show, and TV's Kyle and Linzilla. Plus, we're going to have a bunch of other artists on stage for a couple of the other events that we have. We're having a comedy music burlesque show by the Better Booby Bureau and the Screwbells. So it's a full weekend of comedy music fun.
Our listeners right now are just going, oh my god, I have to make it to Fump Fest. This is a great list of presenters, of all these people who have such creativity to put these things together. Is this an all-ages sort of convention, with the exception of the burlesque show?
It is absolutely an all-ages event. I will say, certain acts can occasionally play a little blue, but there are programs available at the convention to alert you, to let you know which acts are available to all ages and which maybe don't bring the kids to.
So are tickets still available for this show?
Tickets are available at the door. Pre-registration has closed for the most part, but the ticket prices are the same on the website than they will be at the door. So we will have tickets at the door, so we won't be turning people away.
And we've got all that ticket information in our show notes, so you can go to our show notes, or you can go to fumpfest.com to find out all of that information. How about you, Ian? Where can our listeners find more about the Fump and Fump Fest and Insane Ian, who's going to be performing at Fump Fest?
Yes, I am. I am not only hosting Fump Fest, I'm the MC of the event, so you'll be looking at my stupid face between all of the other acts. But I am also performing at Fump Fest. I am the opening act this year, so I'll be performing at 7 o'clock on Friday,
nice.
7 p.m. But you can find, obviously, the songs of the Fump at thefump.com. You can find my music at insaneian.bandcamp.com. Or you can check out my music videos and also all of the other dumb videos that I do, like taste tests and other weird stuff, at youtube.com/insaneian.
Okay, so tell me about your music. What kind of genre of comedy music does your music fall into?
Oh, I hope it falls into the funny category of comedy music. But for the most part, a lot of what I do kind of can be sub-categorized as nerdcore.
Okay.
There's a sub-genre called nerdcore hip-hop. I do some hip-hop songs, but I also do some... I do multiple genres of music, so I'll do pop, I'll do rock, I'll do country, I'll do hip-hop. So kind of like Weird Al in that sense, where I'm tapping a lot of musical genres in the music that I do. And also, like Al, I do both original songs and parody songs. But a lot of my music has a very nerdy leaning. So if you are into a lot of comic books, video games, science fiction, pop culture, stuff like that, that's a lot of what my songs are about.
I don't read any science fiction at all. I read a lot of history books and math. I almost got through that sentence.
You,
no, absolutely. I was being sarcastic, sir. That's all I read is science fiction. So, yes, I look forward to Fump Fest next weekend, August 9th through 11th at the Holiday Inn Chicago O'Hare. Insane Ian, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a privilege.
Good morning. This is Professor Pamela Bedore here to introduce Too Much Scrolling's next Read Together assignment. Join Steve, Chip, and me in reading One Second After by William Fortune. It's a story of struggle and survival after an EMP disrupts all electronics and plunges America into a new age of working together without the aid of technology. What would your day look like if you had no access to electricity? Read One Second After and find out. We will discuss it on August 13th, just as Steve's students report back for school. Find your copy today and take the journey with us. You won't regret it. I'm Pamela Bedore, and I'll see you in the future.
I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
Absolutely. I think we need to thank our two guests this week. John Jackson Miller, his new book is coming out on our Amazon store today, Star Trek The Enterprise War. And Insane Ian, who is so excited about Fump Fest that is coming to the Holiday Inn Chicago O'Hare August 9th through 11th. Go to fumpfest.com to get your tickets. If you need more information about anything that you've heard today, give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4TMS. Our website is toomuchscrolling.com. Our email is toomuchscrolling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. You can find us on Stitcher and TuneIn Radio, and you can ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Chip Hessen Flood.
We'll see you in the future. So we don't talk about what I want to talk about. It's what I want to thank you for. What I want to thank you for. It means so very much to me without you. I would never see the light. Snoogans.